Yeah, so the idea this time is to try to finish off explaining the three most interesting grand unification schemes at the level of their group theoretic approach to re-encapsulating the structure of the standard model, and explain how they fit together. Okay, so for starters, to pick up where we left off last time, we were almost at the end of explaining how SU5 works. So the first few minutes, I want to finish off how SU5 works, and then there will be a couple of calculations that will be left to check in the tutorial to see how that works. But hopefully this will already give the gist. And then I want to we'll see that once we understand how SU5 works, it'll be pretty quick to see how SO10 and Patty Salam work and what their relationships to one another are. Okay, so just to recap here, the starting point last time was we took our table of the gauge group and representation, matter representation for the standard model. We rewrote it as by saying, you know, we just rewrote it in this new notation where I wrote what the representation space that SU3, SU2, and U1 act on for each particle. And recall that we renormalized the U1 charges just as a matter of convention by multiplying mol by 6 so that they all have integer values. And so then these are the representation spaces for the 6 irreducible representations for the particles in the standard model. And then here are the representation spaces that the corresponding antiparticles live in. And so the total space is the direct sum of all 12 of these spaces. And in particular, it's convenient to group it into two pieces, the space of all the space F of all the left chiral spinners and the space of F star of corresponding antiparticles, which are, in other words, the right chiral spinners. So the left chiral spinners are, you know, Q left, the antiparticle of U right, the antiparticle of D right, L left, the antiparticle of new right and the antiparticle of E right, okay? Great. So, and then we said, well, now we're gonna try to fit, we're gonna see if we can take as the, we're gonna unify all the forces of nature. There appeared to be three different forces here. We're gonna try to unify them all into SU5. Okay, SU5 has as a subgroup, SU3, times SU2 times U1. And we were writing an element of this subgroup as U3, comma, U2, U3, an SU3 matrix, U2, an SU2 matrix, and alpha, a complex phase, in other words, an element of U1. And we had arrived at the idea that basically our only option for embedding this into SU5 was an embedding like this, where a given element here is written as a 5x5 unitary determinant 1 matrix. It was written as an element of, is embedded in SU5 in this block diagonal form, where we have an upper 2x2 block, which where we wrote alpha cubed times U2, a 2x2 or 2x2 unitary. And then a lower 3x3 block where we wrote alpha to the minus 2 times U3, our 3x3 unitary. And again, the reason that we had to put alpha cubed up here and alpha to the minus 2 down here is so that, well, this thing is already determinant 1 and this thing is already determinant 1. So now when we multiply the whole thing, so forget about those. And the determinant of the rest of the thing also has to be 1, so we have two alpha threes up here, three alphas to the minus twos down here, so they cancel for arbitrary alpha. So this matrix still has determinant one, but the magical thing is that that will then, we want to see that then translates into an explanation of a very neat, that simple fact translates into a very neat explanation for why all the different representations in the standard model have the particular weird hypercharge assignments that they do. And so in particular, we said that, so this was the embedding of the subgroup into the full gauge group, and now what is the representation space on which this thing is going to act? Well, again, we said it was, it's a rather nice space. It's just the exterior algebra. So this thing naturally acts on a vector space, which is C5. That vector space has a canonical algebra associated with it, which is the exterior algebra. So that's the space of zero forms in five dimensions plus one forms in five dimensions, direct summed with two forms in five dimensions, forms. Okay, and we said actually this is, we counted and said that the P forms have five choose P dimensions, so this is one dimensional, five dimensional, 10, 10, 5, and 1. And under SU5, under the full group, each of these components transforms separately as an irreducible representation of SU5. So this thing by itself is not an irreducible representation. It actually is reducible. It breaks into six components like this. And moreover, one of the things that you'll show, I was beginning to show it on the board last time when I was showing these identities about how if you take the n-dimensional epsilon tensor, apply n u's to it, then that they leave it invariant, and then you can begin pulling u's across from one side and turning them into u daggers on the other side. So you will complete that thought to show that if you, you know, in the tutorial, you'll show that there's this general fact that if you consider the p forms in n dimensions and ask how they transform, they transform as some irreducible representation of SUN. Okay, alternatively, there are the n minus p forms in n dimensions. They transform as some other irreducible representation of SUN. And what you'll show using that identity about involving epsilon tensors and multiplying by u's on one, so you know, p u's on one side and n minus p u daggers on the other side, you'll see that the conjugate of this representation is exactly isomorphic to this representation. Okay, so really here what we have is the representation that's often called the bold one, in other words, the trivial representation of SU5, bold 5, the 5D representation, bold 10, then this guy is really 10 bar, this guy is really 5 bar, and this, well, that's the trivial one again. Okay, so the final thing we need to, where we got last time, and now the final step is just to show the final step is to show that that's how this vector space transforms under SU5. The final step is to show now how this representation breaks up if instead of acting on it with a general SU5 matrix, we act on it with a subgroup, SU3 times SU2 times U1, embedded this way. And so I'll just show you the first couple of steps of that, and then you'll check the final couple of steps. There's really not much more to check after that, but you'll do the final few steps as part of the tutorial. Okay, so let's see. So we want to see how this thing transforms when we look at the subgroup. Well, let's just check piece by piece. First, look at the zero forms. Well, they already transformed trivially under SU5, so they're going to transform trivially under the subgroup. Okay, so they. So if we write that in our three. Under SU2 and trivially under U1, they transform as charge zero. Okay, what about the one forms? Well, these are anti-symmetric combinations of basis vectors. You know, if we take the five-dimensional basis for C5, E1 through E5, these are anti-symmetric combinations of one of those. So in other words, that it's isomorphic to C5. This is just, you know, anti-symmetrization does nothing when you're only working with a single basis vector. Okay, fine. So to find this one, we just imagine, so now imagine this, we just need to think about how this matrix acts on C5, on a column of five guys. Well, the top, this part will act on the top two components, and how will that behave? Well, so the top two components, there's no U3 acting on them, so they're trivial under U3. There is a U2 acting on them as a doublet, so they form a C2 under SU2. And then there's three alphas, so they have U1 charge three. So this thing breaks, so the first thing we get here is, like we said, trivial under SU3, a doublet under SU2, and charge three under U1. Okay, and then we can look at the bottom three components here. So the bottom three components now do transform as a triplet under SU3. They don't transform under SU2 because there's no SU2 matrix here. And they transform with hypercharge minus two. Okay, and if we look at our list of standard model representations here, C tensor C2 tensor C3, well, we don't quite see that actually. We see C tensor C2 tensor C minus three, and we see C tensor C2 star tensor C3. But we have to remember a fact about group theory, which we've used before. For example, we used it when we defined H twiddle. Recall that we defined H twiddle as I sigma two H star, and then H had transformed as a doublet under SU2. H transforms as a two, so H star transforms as a two bar, but that turns out to be equivalent under a change of basis to a two with this change of basis matrix. So this is actually transformed as a two under SU2 again. So in other words, it's a special fact about SU2 and its fundamental representation that the representation and its charge conjugate are equal. So really we can erase the star here. And so we recognize this as actually the L left, the antiparticle. And this guy, C3, tensor C to the C minus two, is D right. Okay, so far so good. And meanwhile, this guy we see could be either, you know, it could be either new right. So far, we have no reason to prefer calling this thing new right or new right C, since those are identical. What about lambda two of C, five? Okay, well, so we've just seen that C5 breaks up into two pieces, which I'll call V plus W. Okay, so really we're talking about the two forms of some space of the form V plus W. Now, it's a general fact that if you think about it, the two forms, in other words, all the anti-symmetric tensor products you can form from a vector space which you have decomposed into a direct sum of two pieces like this, that's all the anti-symmetric products you can form. That breaks up like this. That's the two forms over the first piece plus the two forms over the second piece plus a piece that transforms just like the tensor product of the two parts. Okay, so now we want to work out these three pieces. Let me just do the first one as an example, and then these other ones will be left for the tutorial. So lambda squared V, so that's two forms over C tensor, C2 tensor, C sub 3. Okay, so these are anti-symmetric pairs of basis vectors drawn from this space. Well, so how is this thing going to, how is that resulting thing going to transform under SU3? Well, if this space is trivial, then taking pairs of them will still be trivial under SU3. So it's going to transform trivially under SU3. Now remember, this C3 is just a notational thing. Really, this is just a two-dimensional vector space. And we're taking the action is here. We're taking the two forms over C2. Well, just like the five forms in C5 were a trivial one-dimensional representation, for the exact same reason, the two forms of C2 are trivial. So actually, this is trivial again under SU2. And finally, now we have pairs of basis vectors, each of which transforms with a phase alpha cubed. So if we take a pair, that'll transform with a factor of alpha to the 6. So this thing has U1 charge 6. Okay, so if we look at our list up here again, that's this. Okay, so this is really ERC. Okay, this is really ERC here. And then again, I leave these for the tutorial, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, yeah, so, and then, to get the, you should make sure you think carefully about this in the tutorial and understand what I mean, but, maybe I'll just leave it, maybe I won't even say it. Let's put it this way. Given what we've already shown, the rest of the pieces here, checking lambda 3, lambda 4, and lambda 5 of C5 should be literally no work. So once you've checked the decomposition of these two pieces, we're really done. And what you find is the stated fact that that lambda C5 under this decomposition exactly breaks down into F plus F star, the standard model representation as defined above. And in particular, you'll notice that all the F terms, all the terms corresponding to the left-handed spinners, actually come from the even degree part of the exterior algebra. So F comes from the zero forms, two forms, and four forms, whereas F star comes from the odd degree parts, lambda 1, one form, the one forms, three forms, and five forms. Okay? So that's the short of it. SU5 does a beautiful job. Okay, so now let's talk about SO10. Okay, so with this way of presenting SU5, it's now very quick to do SO10. So the idea is that the idea will be to just think again about this vector space, the exterior algebra over C5, and just notice that we can define a representation of the 10-dimensional gamma matrices, the 10 gamma matrices that, so in, okay, so normally the gamma matrices you know and love satisfy a relationship like this, where this is the metric in 3+1 dimensional spacetime. Okay, but then you've probably seen that there, that for any metric with any arbitrary signature p, q, there's an analogous set of gamma matrices. And those gamma matrices are the generators of the so-called Clifford algebra, the p, q Clifford algebra. Okay, so the one we usually use in 4D physics is the 3-1 Clifford algebra, but here we're going to talk about the here we're interested in the 10-0 Clifford algebra. In other words, the Clifford algebra that so a representation of these things is exactly what we call a Dirac spinner, and it transforms as it gives the spinner representation of SOP, Q. Well, not quite. Famously, it doesn't quite give a representation of this, because if it really gave a representation of this guy, then if we did a rotation about, and if we did a rotation in any plane by 360 degrees, in this group, we get back to the identity. So the representation matrix should get back to the identity. Whereas with spinners, it doesn't. In spinners, we do a rotation by 2 pi and, the representation matrix comes back to -1. So really, the spinners don't form a representation of this group. They form a representation of so-called spin p, q, which is the double cover of this group that differentiates between these two group elements that only spinners see the difference between. So anyway, so what we're going to be talking about is what physicists commonly call SO10, grand unification, but really is more correctly called spin10, because really the representation will be the spinner representation of SO10, which, as I just mentioned, is really a representation of this double cover spin10. So, and so as I'll review in a moment, once we have a, it's now going to be quick to see that this thing can be reinterpreted as the Dirac spinner, the vector space on which the 10-dimensional Clifford matrices act. So in other words, the Clifford matrices that, the gamma matrices that give anti-commute to delta mu nu, where mu and nu now run from 1 to 10. And then once we have that, that means that from these guys we can construct, we can show that guy transforms as a representation of spin 10. Okay, so we will reinterpret the representation we already built as a representation of spin 10. So let's do that. So basically what we want to show, let's just show the more general fact that what I want to show is that if you have the n-dimensional, the exterior algebra in n dimensions, that can be reinterpreted as the Dirac spinner in 2n dimensions. So how do we do it? So we just define two operators here. So suppose that we take as the orthonormal basis for n-dimensional space E1 through En, then we define two operators that act on this vector space, a creation operator, Aj star or Aj dagger, which the way it acts on this vector space is suppose you take any vector in this vector space, any form, psi, this operator maps it to Ej wedge psi. So it maps it to a form of one higher degree. And then there's the corresponding annihilation operator Aj, which it does, roughly speaking, the inverse thing. So if you give it any, suppose you have some string of, suppose you have some form that's a wedge product of basis vectors EI1 through EIP, so you have some P form, then if one of the E's that appears in this form is EJ, you permute it through to the beginning, picking up as many minus signs as needed from all the other E's it passes through, and then you kill it. Or in other words, A passes through all the E's, picking up minus signs as it goes, until it eats E sub J. So in other words, this thing, if E sub J is here in the kth position, then this is equal to, from what I just said, e to the minus 1 to the k minus 1, because you have to pass, A has to pass through k minus 1 e's on the way over, and then it just removes the e sub k, it's the same expression, but with that e sub k removed. Okay, where we've just, yeah, so really now, there used to be p guys multiplied together here. Now I'm keeping the same labeling, but now there's really only p minus one of them because I came in and I ate E sub j. Okay, so that's how this guy operates. If there is an E sub j present in this expression, if there isn't, it just annihilates this thing. It sets it to zero. It sets the whole expression to zero. Okay, and so it's easy to check that if you just apply, imagine you take any form, and you first apply A sub j, and then you apply A sub I, and then you do the reverse. So you first apply A sub I, and then you apply A sub j. Okay, in other words, you take the anticommutator of AI and AJ. That always vanishes, no matter what you act on. Similarly, if you do the same exercise with AJ star and AI star, their anticommutator vanishes. But if you take the anticommutator of AI with AJ star, that the answer vanishes unless they're the same, in which case the answer is that you do nothing to the form you act on. Or in other words, that the anticommutator here is 1. So in other words, this means if you act with the anticommutator on any form, you get back that form unchanged. Okay, but so you'll recognize these, of course, as the creation and annihilation operators for a fermion, for a set of n fermions. Now the normally you think of it as acting on a Fock space of those n fermions. Now, in this case, it's acting on this vector space, exterior algebra in n dimensions. So we see that can be reinterpreted as a Fock space for n fermions. And in particular, we can define now, we can use these things. Once we know these relations, it's easy to see that we can define gamma matrices. So let's define the gamma matrix 2i to be given by AI plus AI star. So that would be a Hermitian conjugation, but I'm going to want an extra minus sign. I want an extra minus sign in my defining relation here. I want to get this minus sign right. So I have to stick in an extra I, and then so the even gamma I's will be, the even gammas will be constructed like that, and then the odd gammas, 2i plus 1, will be ai minus ai star. So that's an anti-Hermitian thing, so I'm not going to need an extra I there. So let me define gamma 2i, let me define, so I started with n different a's. So in this way, I define n plus n equals 2n gammas. So let me use Greek indices for the index that runs from 1 to 2n, or I guess the way I labeled it here, it actually runs from 0 to 2n minus 1. So now it runs from 1 to 2n. So it's easy to check using these relations that these guys do indeed now satisfy the Clifford algebra that we described before. Okay, so we have, but in 2n dimensions. Mu and nu run from 1 to 2n. Okay, so just to say it again, what you may be familiar from previous, but what we have shown is that by introducing these operators and then defining gamma from them, we have introduced operators on this space that satisfy exactly the defining relations of the Clifford algebra. Or in other words, we have shown that we have shown that this forms a representation of the Clifford algebra. Well, famously, there is only one representation of the Clifford algebra, so we found it. So this is nothing but the Dirac spinner in n dimensions, n Euclidean dimensions, here, because again, the signature we're looking at here is 10, 0. Now, as you also, I won't check this on the board, but as you also have probably been forced to check at some point in your life, if you define an operator J mu nu, which is, okay, maybe I forgot to check exactly what the right normalization is. It might be I over 4, but anyway. There's an operator that's proportional to the commutator of gamma mu and gamma nu. Remember, the anti-commutator of gamma mu and gamma nu becomes just a number. But the commutator is not. You give something that's anti-symmetric in mu and nu. So this thing now satisfies, these objects now satisfy the Lie algebra for SON, or for SO2N, or equivalently, the Lie algebra for spin 2N, which is the thing we're actually after here. Okay, so they satisfy this formula. You probably have had to check at some point in a field theory class that if you commute these guys and you just use this defining relation, you find that this is equal to I times 4 terms, one of which, where each term involves a J and a delta mu nu. And the J carries always a pair of these indices, and the delta mu nu carries a different pair. And there's 4 different ways to pair them up, and so that's why you get 4 different terms. Okay, anyway, I don't want to go through the details. The point is just that the gammas, if you look at how the gammas act, each gamma involves 1A and 1A dagger. So when a gamma acts on a P form, it kind of moves it into a combination of the annihilation part moves it down to a P minus 1 form, the creation part moves it up to a P plus 1 form, but it moves it by one step in either direction. But the Lorentz generators always involve a product of two gammas. So when a Lorentz generator acts on here, it always moves P form up or down by 2 degrees, by an even number of degrees. So, which is to say that under the Clifford algebra, this forms an irreducible representation of the Clifford algebra, the Dirac spinner. But under the Lorentz group, which can be generated using pairs of Clifford commutators of two gamma matrices, this thing splits into two pieces, the even order forms, the zero form, two form pieces, et cetera, and the odd order forms. Okay, and so this thing is called the, these are the two, this is another way to say the fact that in even dimension, 2n, the Dirac spinner always breaks into two irreducible representations under the Lorentz group. The two Weyl spinners, the left Weyl spinner, left chiral Weyl spinner, and the right chiral Weyl spinner. Okay, so that's, so far this is just a general fact about mathematical physics, that's about the mathematical universe, which is very important to know in many different contexts, that the, you know, the differential forms are really equivalent to spinners. There are two different ways of talking, that forms and exterior algebra is really equivalent to spinners. There are two different ways of talking about the same thing. This is a thing that shows up again and again in supersymmetry. It's a very important kind of duality in how you can talk about things. In particular, though, again, to come back to our case, so this was the left Weyl spinner of spin 2n, the group spin 2n, or in other words, what physicists would usually call SO2n, and the right Weyl spinner of spin 2n. But in our case, we have been studying lambda C5, and so that gets reinterpreted as the Dirac spinner in 10 dimensions, 10 Euclidean dimensions. And when it breaks up into the left Weyl spinner of spin 10 and the right Weyl spinner of spin 10. And since SU5 is a subgroup, since SUN, by this same reasoning, is always a subgroup of SO2N, so now this thing is an irreducible representation of spin 10, but if we go to the subgroup, the embedded subgroup, SU5, this breaks into a reducible representation of SU5, corresponding to the zero forms, two forms, and four forms. The irreducible representation we were talking about here. That it's this piece plus this piece plus this piece. And similarly, this guy, which was irreducible under spin 10, breaks into a reducible thing under the five forms plus, namely the five forms, the one forms plus the three forms plus the five forms. And then from there, we already know that SU3 times SU2 times U1 is embedded in SU5, and under that, you know, we're back to our starting point for SU5. So we already know that we can further break that down in just the way we discussed before to the standard model. Okay, so that shows that SO10 gives a standard model is a subgroup of SU5, which is a subgroup of SO10. And the advantage, so what's in short, what's better and what's worse about SO10 compared to SU5? Well, the good news about SU5, let's say first the good news about SO10. The good news about SO10 is that, so here we had already taken what appeared to be three forces of nature with three different gauge couplings and unified them into one force of nature with just a single unified gauge coupling. So here we've done that again. I mean, here again, we only have one simple group, so one fundamental force. But here we took a very complicated fermion representation, F plus F star, which had many pieces, and we embedded it in a exterior algebra, which had fewer pieces, but still a lot. I mean, so this, again, this was still a reducible representation under SU5. It had still six different components, 1 plus 5 plus 10, et cetera. But by going to SO10, we've really completely unified the fermions. So now they lie all the left-handed fermions in the standard model have all been unified into a single thing, which is the left-handed spinner of SO10. And all of the corresponding antiparticles, the right-handed fermions in the standard model, have been unified into the right-handed spinner of SO10. So notice that those are two different spinners that I'm talking about. I mean, when I say left-handed fermions in the standard model, I'm talking about left-handed four-dimensional fermions. That's how their spinner index transforms in 4D, under 4D Lorentz transformations. Here I'm talking about a different notion of left-handedness, which is left-handedness with respect to this thing. But nevertheless, it's very elegant that they match up. And this theory doesn't provide an explanation for why that is. Actually, I'll talk next week about a thought about why that is. But anyway, that's one of the key advantages of SO10, maybe the most important advantage, is that in addition to unifying the forces, it unifies the fermions. Okay, all the particles are in one irrep, all the antiparticles are in the other irrep. So that's very beautiful. Now, another important difference to say is that SO10 requires new right. Okay, if we don't include new right in the standard model, we don't have 16 fermions in a generation. We only have 15. So it doesn't work. We need the right-handed neutrino for SO10 to work. So SO10 predicts the existence of new right. And in fact, it was the way that people discovered the predicted seesaw mechanism. The fact that in SO10 they needed new right, and when they wrote down the standard model including new right, they noticed that there was this phenomenon that we described last week, on Monday, you could write down a very heavy Majorana term for new right, which didn't involve the coupling to the Higgs, and that as a consequence, that there was a predicted very light mass for the left-handed neutrino, for the light neutrinos. The left-handed neutrinos is basically that went as 1 over the mass of the heavy neutrinos. That came out of this theory as a prediction. In SU5, to make it look more beautiful, I included the right-handed neutrino. Remember, the right-handed neutrino was showing up here as the zero in the zero forms, and then its antiparticle was showing up in the five forms. And so I included it because when I included it, I could make this statement that the representation space was the full exterior algebra, which is certainly much nicer. But on the other hand, I'm perfectly allowed to just erase these two components and just work with this slightly smaller representation of SU5 consisting of the 5 plus the 10 plus the 10 bar plus the 5 bar. That would still give me a perfectly well-defined Yang-Mills theory. And back in the 1970s, before the right-handed neutrino had been discovered, or before, I should say, there was evidence for neutrino masses and neutrino oscillations, or in any case, before there was evidence that anyone was paying attention to for those things, people actually preferred SU5 for this reason. They thought it was a more minimal thing. It only involved the known particles in the standard model at that time, without having to involve any other extra particles, which people regarded as too speculative at that time. Or many, you know, that was a widely held view, that this was an advantage. And another advantage here is that in SU5, the rank of SU5 is 4. In other words, that means this is some Lie algebra, and it has some, well, break time. I think I went too long without a break. I'm just going to randomly impose it at this moment. Does anyone have a song that they would like to sing, or a poem by short poem that they would like to recite, or a soliloquy from Hamlet? Okay, so. I will tell you, if you want to know, you do, that, you know, when I was very young, so these stories about my grandmother, you know, my grandfather died when I was 7, so until I was 7, there was my grandfather there also, and that's an important some stories about him. So one thing was that he was very keen. He was a very keen woodworker, and he had converted the garage of their house to a kind of woodworking shop. And from a much too young age, that he got me all of these woodworking tools, and that's mainly what I did when he was alive. Was I went over to their house and would just play around with those things in his shop. But so in particular, I just have a bit of advice for, if you're ever dealing with children later on in your lives, which is that, it's okay to give a little kid a saw. I think they can pretty much handle a saw as long as it's not too sharp, because somehow you don't really get your, this is really stupid advice. Anyway, but so for me, got me a little saw, and I remember never hurting myself with the little saw. But he also got me like a hammer. And there was a lot of hammering nails, and there I just could not learn to hammer a nail without hitting my thumb prior to, I don't know what age it was, 6 or 7 or something, but I just have so many memories. It was just such a big part of my youth, was just hitting my thumb with that hammer, and it really hurt. So that would be my recommendation to you, is maybe go with saws but not hammers until they get to 7. Okay, so We're almost there. We're really close. So again, I was giving you the sales pitch for SO10. I just want to try to give the fair counter sales pitch for SU5. The first counter sales pitch is that we don't strictly know that the right-handed neutrino exists yet. Again, it could be that if you just have this theory with a with no right-handed neutrinos, but just higher dimension operators, non-renormalized operators of dimension 5 and higher, you can still get neutrino masses from those. And so you can get that in this theory without having to invoke an extra particle we haven't detected yet. Furthermore, here, because the rank of this group is equal to the rank of this group, the embedding of this guy in this guy is very tight. Okay, so what we saw basically is that once you put the SU2 in the upper block and the SU3 in the lower block, there was really only one way up to normalization for how to put U1 in there so that it commuted with those guys. There's only room that's coming from the fact that the rank is equal. The rank. Remember, this is a Lie algebra. It's a vector space of some dimension. But the rank corresponds to the dimension of the maximal subspace within that vector space of generators that all commute with each other. So the fully commuting subspace of these two things matches. So once we have rank 1 plus rank 2, here, there's only one dimension left. We want to stick in one more U1, which is a one-dimensional Lie group, and we want it to commute with all of this. And there's only one dimension of rank left, so there's only one way to fit that in. And so this embedding scheme predicts the advantage, the great advantage of it is that it predicts the right hypercharges on the nodes. There's no freedom. Here, the rank is 5, okay? This is a group of one higher rank. So there's room to fit in addition to, I've explained to you that you can fit the standard model gauge group in here in such a way that you get exactly the right standard model charges out. But, and it's exactly by embedding first SU5 and then the entire standard model gauge group inside SU5. But there's room to do other things here. So the symmetry breaking does not have to go that way. And in particular, there's room to fit one more U1. In addition to the U1 hypercharge that we see, there's room to fit one more U1, which commutes with everything, which turns out to be U1 baryon minus lepton number, as you will be checking on your homework. But in particular, that means that there's also room for any arbitrary linear combination of those. And so, in a sense, the disadvantage of this guy, because it's less of a tight fit, is that it gives less of an explanatory, it gives less explanatory precision in terms of telling you why that table is precisely what it is. So I think that's, let me see, is there anything else I wanted to say about that before we go on to Petty Salam? No. Okay, so that's the end of SO10. Any questions about that before I very quickly introduce you to Patty Salam and then okay, let's do it. So the details of Patty Salam, I believe, are going to be worked out in the tutorial. So I just want to introduce you to the basic idea. It's very analogous, in a way, to what we did for SU5. So it's just kind of a useful exercise to practice some of the things we did for SU5. But also, the point is, it gives a different... SU5 did a nice job of explaining certain things about the standard model. We want to see that Patty Salam does a nice job of explaining other patterns in the standard model. And then we want to see that both SU5 and Patty Salam both fit into SO10. They really represent two different possible breaking patterns. So what's the idea in brief? Well, you know, if you look at this table, a thing that jumps out is that the quarks are a lot like the leptons. The leptons are like a colorless analog of the quarks. So the left-handed lepton is like the colorless partner of the left-handed quark. The right-handed neutrino is like the colorless partner of the right-handed up quark, and the right-handed electron is like the colorless partner of the right-handed down quark. So, for example, in each case, so yeah, just like we have a doublet of consisting of U left and an SU2 doublet consisting of U left and D left here. Here we have two corresponding singlets, U right and D right, and the average of their charges is equal to this charge. And similarly here for the leptons, just like we have SU2 doublet with nu left and E left, here we have the corresponding right-handed fields nu right and E right, and the average of their charges is this charge. There's a couple of patterns that suggest that they're related. So the idea, the first point in Patty Salam, is to try to reinterpret the leptons as really the fourth color of quark. Okay, so instead of SU3, we're going to promote SU3 to SU4. We're going to try to instead of having quarks transform in a 3 under SU3, we're going to say maybe in the fundamental theory they transformed in a 4 under SU4. and that it was only as a consequence of symmetry breaking that the fourth color got broken off and called leptons. Okay? The other pattern that jumps out about the Standard Model is that there seems to be a parallel between the right-handed and left-handed fermions. Here we have two left-handed quarks, and then we have corresponding right-handed quarks, which have the same color charge, and which have the same average hypercharge. But the only difference is that the left-handed guys, an odd fact, is that it appears to be left-right asymmetric. The left-handed guys transform under SU2, the right-handed guys don't. Again, the thought in Patty Salam is, oh, maybe actually, in the more fundamental theory, it's left-right symmetric. These guys transform under one SU2, which we'll call this SU2, we'll recall it SU2 left, to refer to the fact that it only acts on the left-handed guys. But maybe in the fundamental theory, there's another SU2 that similarly groups these guys into a doublet, which we would call Q right. And similarly, down here, that SU2 would group these guys into a doublet, which we would call L right. OK, so the suggested gauge group is SU4 times SU2 left times SU2 right. Now, from the description I just gave, we also have the suggested representation. Okay, we're going to have this thing act on, again, instead of a quark, instead of the left-handed quark we're going to take this quark and this lepton and put them together into a super quark, a four-component quark. So instead of being a 3 under SU3 and a 2 under SU2, it'll be a 4 under SU4 and a 2 under SU2. Okay, so our first field will be C4 under SU4. We'll transform as C4 tensor C2 under SU2 left, but then it doesn't, again, it doesn't seem to transform at all under any other SU2 right. Okay, so it's trivial under the next one. And then the guy is, again, the idea is that we'll do the same thing, the mirror symmetric thing. We'll group these guys together into a 4 under SU4. Now they are seen to be trivial under this SU2, SU2 left, but we'll imagine that they are a doublet under SU2 right. Okay, so in other words, they transform like four colors, no SU2 left charge, but a doublet under SU2 right. Okay, so that is the proposal for the fermions, and then again, there's the corresponding, if we call this thing V, then there's also the corresponding anti-fermion, the conjugate representations. And we want to show that this we have our standard model subgroup. So let's write an element of this group in the form U4, a 4x4 matrix, U2 left, a 2x2 matrix, and U2 right, a 2x2 matrix. Now we have our subgroup that we want to embed, just like with SU5, just like we tried to embed the standard model in SU5, we want to embed the standard model now in that subgroup. And again, let's call an element of this subgroup U3, just the same name we did before, U3 comma U2 comma alpha, where alpha is a U1 phase. U2 and U3 are 2x2 and 3x3 unitary matrices. So how can we embed them? Well, we know we want SU3 to embed in SU4. The whole idea is we're expanding the color by one. So this U4 matrix will, we want it to be sort of block diagonal with a 3x3 block and a 1x1 block. So that's how we're going to embed U3. Here, we want this U2 left to be exactly the usual SU2, as we just described. So that's U2 goes there. This U2 right, We don't know yet. That's some 2x2 matrix. Okay, and now we haven't yet embedded U1. How can we embed it? Well, again, the U1 has to commute with SU2 and SU3. So there's just no way to put U1 in here in such a way that it commutes with this guy, because this is a 2x2 matrix and it's already filled out by SU2. There's the only thing that would commute with that is the identity matrix proportional to alpha to some power, but that wouldn't have determinant 1. So we just can't stick a alpha in there. Here, so far we have nothing, so we can get away by sticking some alphas in here. We could put in alpha to the q and alpha to the minus q in this 2x2 matrix. And that would have determinant 1. That would be unitary. Okay, so we can stick that in there. And here, again, we can stick a 3x3 unitary matrix proportional to alpha to the p, as long as we correspondingly, in the bottom 4-4 component of the matrix, we put alpha to the minus 3p to keep the determinant 1 everywhere. So the embedding has to be something like that for some integer, for some values of p and q. And so the thing to show, the thing that I think you'll show in the tutorial is that for an appropriate choice of p and q, if you look at the breakdown of this representation under when it's acted on by this subgroup, that it breaks down exactly to the same standard model representation, F plus F star, that we discussed before. Okay, and so that, that completes, maybe I'll just say very quickly, I just want to, just to complete the discussion of the group theoretic aspects in this lecture, we've seen why SU5 and its representation fit into SO10. It's very quick to see why Patty Salam fits into SO10 also. In particular, we had this gauge group SU4 times SU2 times SU2. Okay, but SU4 is really the same. That's isomorphic to spin 6. In other words, the double cover of the spinner cover of SO6. SU2 times SU2 is also isomorphic to another group, spin 4, or in other words, the spin double cover of SO4. And so then it's clear that spin 6 times spin 4, I mean SO4 times SO6 times SO, so this is then a subgroup of spin 10. Okay, because any fundamental representation of spin 10 or of SO. This is the group that preserves the 10 component flat metric. This is the subgroup that preserves the top 6 components and the top and the bottom 4 components separately. Okay, so this is a natural subgroup of this guy. And now I'm going too long. And it also turns out that you can, if you think about it, you can reinterpret this representation space. You can just rewrite it as C4 plus C4 star tensor C2 C1 plus C times C2. But these are really the two Weyl spinners that make the Dirac spinner in 6 dimensions. In other words, we can reinterpret this guy as lambda of C3. These are the two Weyl spinners that add up to the Dirac spinner in 4 dimensions. So this guy, by the argument that we had given in earlier in the lecture, can be reinterpreted as lambda C2. So lambda C2 times lambda C3 has a natural inclusion in lambda C5, which again is our SO10 representation space. So we have these three gauge groups, but really two of them fit into SO10 and represent two different intermediate breaking patterns down to the standard model. So they're all just different, there are different ways to see the same fundamental structure hiding in the standard model, and or at least in one generation of fermions in the standard model. And our goal, the next goal, is to understand some of the other structures in the standard model, and then also to understand what the physical interpretation of all of this little group theoretic algebraic niceness is. And so that's we'll talk about that next week. All right. Any questions? Have a nice week.